Okay, just as a little bit of an introduction, there's a Mishnah in Smachas. The Mishnah says, Kach hayu chaburos shebirushalayim osin. This is what different groups in Yerushalayim, different chaburos in Yerushalayim used to do. Elu lebeis evel, this group was involved in avelus. This group took care of people who were in grief and mourning. Elu lebeis mishten, those who took care of parties. So there were party planners, caterers, musicians, different chaburos in Yerushalayim that took care of that. And I often ask why avelus is listed first, and I imagine the simple answer is that what? Ah, Tav Leleches LeBeis Avel Mileches LeBeis Mishneh, and based on that pasuk, the Mishnah says it first, and that's correct. However, if you think about it, there is another reason that's very practical why avelus is first, and that is because a community can live without a caterer. There's a time before Simcha. Now we make a l'chaim the night of an engagement, kids come home, it's a l'chaim, but it's not that terrible if you don't have all the right schnapps or whatever. But it's, you have time. There's a bris, you got a week, there's time. When it comes to avelus, if a community is not set up how to deal with avelus, then they really can't function, because avelus requires an immediate response. Halach is you have to bury the same day, you cover to Peren by Yom Ahu, and there has to be something. You have to have a cemetery set up, you have to have a Chavar Kedisha set up. There has to be a way in which to deal with a person who died. So that's number one. The other Gemara that I usually start with is the Gemara in Ma'ir Katan. And the Gemara in Ma'ir Katan tells a story based on Halach. The Halacha says, Meis Ba'ir, person dies in the city. Kol bnei ha'ir asurin ba'asiyas melacha. Everyone in the city is usur, is forbidden from doing any work. The responsibility of burying someone is a responsibility that is on every member of the community. Not the family, it's everyone. So the Gemara tells a story that Rav Hamnuna was in the south of Eretz Yisrael, and he heard the sound that indicated that someone had died. They used to announce it with blowing of a shofar. And he heard the sounds, and he knew someone died, and he saw people continuing to work. So his response was, Shamtinu, put them into Cherev. They're going against a halacha openly. They should be put into Cherev. So he was told, Chaburus Ikubi'ir, there's a Chaver Kadisha in the city. There's a Chaver Kadisha in the city. Then the Chaver Kadisha removes the responsibility from everyone else, and they take over that responsibility and allow everyone in the community to be able to function and to be able to continue with their lives and continue to work. So the reason I open with this halacha is, first of all, it gives you an insight into the overriding responsibility of taking care of a person who died. Okay? That's to be returned, by the way. Okay? It's just to be seen. Return it later. It's fine. Just it's not for the taking, because I only brought one copy of each. But the point is that the Chevra Kadisha removes that responsibility. And the reason I bring that up is, number one, to show how important it is, but also I firmly believe that a Rav, a rabbi in any community, is automatically a member of that Chevra Kadisha. Because not that the Chevra Kadisha, not that he is going to do the Tahara, okay, but he needs to be involved in order to make sure that the person is going to be taken care of appropriately. There are questions that come up, and very often the Rav needs to be involved. The Rav needs to be involved in terms of setting a time, making sure the family chooses to do the Kfura appropriately. There are questions may come up, whether the person should be buried here, buried in Eretz Yisrael, should they wait for a family member, should they not wait for a family member. There are an endless number of issues that arise. And in order to bury someone, it's not just the Kfura itself that's the issue, it's all the peripheral things that arise as well that need to be addressed. And the Rav must de facto be part of that. And so I always say the Rav is at least a member of the Chabura, if not the Rosh Sheva Chabura. That's all you saw. There's a bunch of, there's a whole folder. Okay, it's a shame. Maybe we'll send it on to you. You can give it out another time. It's not another problem. Thank you very much. Okay, so in any case, that is the introduction that I'd like to give. The other point that I will focus on is, it's actually coming up next week. Vasisa Imadi Chesed Shalemis, Yaakov Avinu calls Yosef to his bedside and he says, please do with me Chesed and Emes, kindness and truth. This is where the name Chesed Shalemis comes from. Burial is considered the ultimate Chesed. There's no reciprocity. The person who's receiving this Chesed does not ever return that Chesed to you. So that's one issue. But I think there's another meaning that is very important for us. When we need to know how to perform Chesed, particularly Chesed Shalemis, we need to realize that the Chesed is defined by Emes. I'll tell you a very beautiful vart that I once heard from Rabbi Grumblatt, Zachor Levracha, Rabbi Yosef Grumblatt, the Queen's Jewish Center. And he once said this at Nezra's Torah Malav Malka, and I've repeated it a million times because it happens to fit very well with the work that I do, but it really has very far-reaching meaning and significance on a lot of different levels. But we're all familiar with the brisa that we say every morning after the Berachas HaTorah. We say, L'dvarm shadam alcha perasev b'olam hazev, akeren kayemes b'olam haba, and it goes on to list all kinds of very special mitzvahs. Among them is Bikur Cholin, Alvayas Hameis, Iyun Fila, making peace between friends, Kibur Aveim, all kinds of really nice mitzvahs. And at the end it says, V'talmud Torah k'neged kulam, that the learning of Torah, the study of Torah is equal to all of them. And the pashut meaning is, the simple pshat is, that if you took all these mitzvahs and put it on one side of the scale, and you took Talmud Torah and put it on the other side of the scale, Talmud Torah would balance all of them. Okay, Torah is one of those mitzvahs that's really connected to Kol Torah, and therefore it balances, it's equal in value, in importance, however you define it, schar, to all of these. Okay, he wanted to teach it a little bit al pidrush, and he said, the Talmud Torah connected kulam might also mean that you need, for all of these mitzvahs, to understand Kibbut Av'eim, to understand Bikur Cholin, to understand Halvayas HaMeis, you need the study of Torah to reflect upon all of them, using the word Keneged, like Ezer Keneged, or like a wife reflects upon a husband. Together, they make a complete whole. Okay, together, they're able to accomplish perfection. Okay, so what he's trying to say is that Talmud Torah Keneged Kula means that if you want to do Bikur Cholim appropriately, or Kibbut Av'eim appropriately, or Halvayas HaMeis appropriately, you need Talmud Torah to reflect upon it. And I think in this area, and it's interesting, this is my own little pshat, that if you look through all the things in that particular brisa, you will find that they're all the things that we think we don't need to learn about. Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick, everyone knows how to visit the sick. You go to the hospital, you visit the guy, he just had a heart attack, you sit down on his bed, you take his hand, you spend an hour traveling to get there, and you park the car, and it's $20 for the parking, or $30, whatever it is, and you come and you sit there and say, Jack, I love you. I'm so happy that, thank God, you made it through the heart attack. You've had, the prognosis is great, but you know you're going to have to change your lifestyle. You have to start taking vacations, maybe slow down a little bit, lose 30, 40 pounds, and by the time you finish with your speech of love, he's about to have another heart attack. Okay, is that Bikur Cholim? It's the way we would do it, but it's not with Torah to reflect upon it. The idea is Bikur Cholim, you come in and you say, I'm davening for you, what can I do to help you? That's Bikur Cholim. It's a very different perspective if you look at it from the Hilchos Bikur Cholim. And the same thing is true in Halvayas HaMeis. There are a lot of things that are just, we absorb from our culture, and we don't realize that that's not necessarily the Torah's view of Chesed. So if we want to do Chesed, we need that the Chesed be defined by Emes, which is Torah. Torah is Emes. And that's the idea. So what we really need to know is, what does the Torah feel is the appropriate thing at a specific time. And so what we're going to try to do is cover a lot of different things, a lot of different areas that Rabbanim are going to need in order to deal with their communities at the end of life. And unfortunately, the Sfarim, although there are many more now than there were 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but it's not that clear. The Shulchan Aruch on a lot of this is not that clear. And there are a lot of variables. A lot has to do with just our own communities and the realities of American life in the year 2015. So we're going to try to cover this. So let me begin by suggesting that when you come in as a Rav, there may very well be a need, and I would say there is always a need, to educate your community. And the time to educate them about end-of-life issues is not when someone dies or suddenly you get a phone call, I just put my mom or my wife or my husband into hospice. At that point, things are very complicated by emotion, by pressure of all kinds. We need to educate our community. And interestingly enough, my organization, which is the National Association of Chevra Kaddisha, I work for, normally Rabbi Penna gives me an introduction, so let me tell you in a minute or less my background. Okay, I got smicha from Yeshiva Chavetz Chaim in Queens, and I've been the head of the Chevra Kaddisha of the Rabbanim of Queens for the last 35 years, okay?
First job.
What?
Was that your first job?
That was actually my second job. I was a Rav in a small shul in Queens, which I actually had at the same time I took over the Chevra Kaddisha. But it was, it was my first big-time job, if you will, although it started rather small. We are still the largest Chevra Kaddisha in the country, okay? And we cover a large area. We cover Queens and all of Long Island, so that's a lot of people. So we handle about 2,500 cases a year. And so that's my main work. But I started something called the National Association of Chevra Kaddisha, NASC, and we've been creating all kinds of programs. So actually right now we've created a program called Team Shabbos. I don't know if you've seen any ads in newspapers. I don't know if you read the Jewish press or Mishpacha, Yated, probably not, Hamodia, you know, the kind of Jewish newspapers, not forget the Jewish week. But the point is, we've been advertising for the last few weeks. And we started with this advertisement, which was Respect Life. Since we're a Chevra Kaddisha, we wanted to make it very alive and happy looking, okay? So it's Respect Life. And then we had join the team. Now, team stands for Traditional End-of-Life Awareness Movement. And the goal is that every single shul in the United States, hopefully every shul that you attend next Shabbos, the Rav will speak about something to do with end of life. We have over 250 shuls signed up. I'd say most of the shuls outside of the metropolitan New York area, like Borough Park and Flatbush and Williamsburg. Okay, we have some in those communities, but beyond that, many, many shuls are signed up in Teaneck and Passaic and so on. Rabbi Schwartz, right here in this neighborhood. Okay, but the idea is we're encouraging Rabbanim to speak about something to do with end of life at Parshas Vayechi. And I actually started that in Queens in the early 80s, and now it went national, so we're looking to encourage. We opened a website, you can take a look at it, it's called teamshabbos.org, okay? And it's something that we hope will pick up steam. This is the first time we've really done it nationally on this level, and that's something. But the point is this, that you need to educate your communities about end-of-life issues. First of all, value of life, because there are going to be questions as to DNRs and what to do with end-of-life. When should a person go on hospice? When should they not go on hospice? We live in a world where people, the medical profession just wants you to throw in the towel, and basically if you're over 65 or 70 and you have something that's rather serious, why waste all that money? You're never going to play golf again, so it's not worth it, okay? The Torah view is different, so that's an issue. Be prepared with living wills, halachic living wills, writing a will, buying karka. There's an endless amount of issues that can be addressed, and you need to educate your community. So that is number one. Encourage people in your shul to write a tzavah, to write a will, to realize also that wills have to be written halachically. Halachically, a wife doesn't automatically inherit a house. In fact, if you know the halacha is that a wife doesn't yashin her husband. Okay, but it's always assumed in today's world that that is the American law, that if somebody dies, their wife, their spouse, usually gets the house. Okay, those are things that can be addressed in the tzavua properly and can be done properly. But if we want to follow halacha, we need to know that there are halachas that deal with tzavua. Making sure that a bechor is taken into account. The halacha is the bechor against pishnayim. Okay, is your will reflect that? There are ways of doing it, okay, in which you can do it so that the actual transaction of the tzavua takes place a minute before you die. Okay, that's one of the ways of doing it. There are other ways of doing it, but it says a minute before I die, my nechasim, my property, my everything that I own should be distributed to such and such, and so it's not a will that falls into the category of the Torah. The Torah is responsible for will when a person dies, and that's a way of getting around it. There are a lot of different ways of doing it, but it has to be taken into account, and people should be encouraged to write a tzavua. How many families are destroyed because someone dies and there's a war going on between the kids as to who gets what and so on and so forth, okay? Buying karka. Very many people don't want to buy plots, okay? I would encourage everyone who's old enough to die to have a plot, okay? And that means pretty much everyone, okay? Now the question is where? You just walk into a cemetery. Let's take someone passes away, there's no plot. They live in Flushing, Queens. And there's a cemetery on Main Street, if you're familiar with that section of the world. You walk into that cemetery, sir, ma'am, some of my family got died. I need a plot. They'll sell you a plot. It's about $7,500 right now. That's their starting price, by the way. Okay, if you know where to go, you can probably get it for $500. Not necessarily the same plot, but a plot in that cemetery. There are societies that you can join, maybe shuls, different societies, whatever it is, that would offer you a plot for a membership of $500. There are a lot of ways of doing it, but that's not the issue, it's not the money. The problem is you walk into a cemetery, anyone who walks into the cemetery can buy a plot. Who says they're Jewish? Maybe they think they're Jewish because their father's Jewish and they're Reform and they believe they're Jewish. They'll be sold a plot. You might be buried right next to them. The halacha is you don't get buried next to a guy. In fact, the halacha is that you don't get buried next to a person who is less observant than you are. Ein kovin tzadik etzel rasha. That doesn't mean the gadol hadar next to a meshumid. We're talking about the gadol hadar. We're talking about people who are Shomer Shabbos, people who are not Shomer Shabbos, people who spend their life learning Torah, people who don't spend their life learning Torah, but are, you know, somewhat observant. There are differences, and the reason is, that's the halacha, by the way. We learned this halacha that you don't bury someone who got chenek together with someone who got sreifa. And both haruge bezdin, but one did a bigger aveira, one did a smaller aveira, they were buried separately. Okay? And that's the halacha. Why, if you're familiar with how cemeteries work, they're generally societies. The Aguda gets buried with people from the Aguda, and the Young Israel people get buried in the Young Israel plot, and so on and so forth. Why? Because of this halacha. We assume that people who are members of the Aguda are generally of a similar type of observance, and therefore they get buried together. The people from the town of Lodz basically were a similar type of people, so they got buried together. That's where the Jewish society concept came from, because of this halacha of Ein Kovin Tzadik Etzel Rasha. But when a person wants to buy a plot, they need to know that either it's a family plot, and they are there as part of a family, where even though there might be different levels of observance, but since there's the common denominator of a family, people will be buried together, and that's generally accepted in halacha, even though it doesn't fit the criteria of Ein Kovin Tzadik Etzel Rasha, but since it's a family, it's considered that that's the covenant that together as a family. But otherwise, it really needs to be very carefully considered as to where you're going to buy karka. To have that in advance is a tremendous advantage, because to start looking for karka when suddenly someone dies, they just don't wake up in the morning, it could delay a levaya for a day. And I'm going to mention this now, but it applies to a lot of things we're going to talk about today, which is when you delay a levaya by a day, that could mean one day, it could mean tomorrow, it could mean Sunday, because tomorrow is Shabbos. Okay? It could also mean chalamoed, if there's a three-day yantif, and someone passes away erev yantif, and they have no grave, and suddenly there's no way of burying them erev yantif, now you're waiting till the middle of yantif. What does that mean for the family? It's not just that you might delay it for 3 days, but it also means that the family has to go through a yantif without having had a kfura. It means the family is going to go through the entire chalamoed without sitting shiva. They'll first start sitting shiva after yantif. That's the halacha. Okay, so now they're going to spend 2 weeks involved in a very heavy avelus, okay? Whereas, if the person died Erev Yantif and was buried Erev Yantif, the Shiva would start before Yantif and would end at Yantif. And that would be the end of the avelus, okay? So it's a very different, there are very big stakes involved, there's a very big difference in how soon the Levaya can take place. So these are all things that need to be understood, and it's going to affect a lot of things we talk about, is that concept. We say we delay a Levaya, doesn't always mean for an hour or two. It could be a day, and sometimes it could be much longer than that. And the consequences could be much more significant than just delaying a Levaya for a day. Okay? Let's move on. So, encourage them. I'm a big believer in having all of their burial information at hand, where their kfura is, where their will might be located, whom to contact. They might have made an arrangement with a funeral home, which rav to contact. All of that information should be had in advance. So it's a good thing to teach people to be prepared for the end of life in a way that is appropriate. And today, it's not really in here because this was not such a big issue when I wrote this in 1997. Okay, and this was the first year that I was actually giving the shiur here. Okay, but the point is now it's a very big thing, which is you need to have a living will, and preferably what we call a halachic living will. Anyone here familiar with living wills? Okay, let me take 2 minutes to explain it. Somebody, chas v'sholom, is in a situation where a person is in an accident, or they have a stroke. They can't speak. And they come into a hospital. Who makes decisions? Now, we'd like to think that a spouse makes decisions, children make decisions, and in some instances, that's what happens because the decisions are pretty clear and someone has to sign for it, and that's fine. However, by law, in most of the United States, the patient has a right to their medical decisions. It's called patient autonomy. However, if the patient cannot speak, they have no right, and no one has a right to make decisions for them. So that if the hospital says, you know, we don't feel this person deserves to be put on dialysis, they're too old, the patient might have said, I want dialysis. But the hospital says, no, our ethics committee made the decision that people in this situation should not be put on dialysis. If there's no one that can speak for that person, the hospital basically is in control. Okay?
Even the relatives can say?
Even the relatives. There is no relative power. There's no power of relative. New York State actually has a law, but it's very limited. And think about it. Let's say the relatives do have the power. Now you have 5 children, the man or the woman was blessed with a nice sized family. Or there are 5 siblings. One lives in Teaneck, one lives in Square Town, okay, one lives in Lakewood, one lives in California in San Francisco. One says, Mom wouldn't want this, and the other one says, Mom would want this. This is what we're supposed to do. Now there's a fight between the siblings. They all have equal power. Okay, so let's even say they all have equal power, and you could be sure that the one that's on the side of what the doctors want is going to be in a much better position. Okay, so therefore, it is prudent. And really, I would say a responsibility of every person, not just rabbis, everyone, over the age of 18, to have a healthcare proxy. This is not my own statement. Wall Street Journal had an article to that effect about 2 years ago. It should be a rite of passage. You turn 18, you need a proxy. You have a right to name an alternate proxy. You can name 3 proxies. You say this person is perverse, and God forbid they can't, they don't want to, someone else. And then they have the same power. Shlua Shalodom Kamoso is the law. when it comes to healthcare proxies. Okay? And then you need two signatures. Doesn't have to be notarized. There are forms very available. The RCA has what they call a halakhic living will. The Aguda has a form called the Advanced Medical Directive. And what this includes is another thing. It's not just the proxy part, but there is also something that the medical world wants people to do, which is a living will. What it means is it's a will not about what happens when I die, but what happens when I'm alive and I need to make medical decisions. And the reasons why the medical world pushes this is because they want to have direction from that person. Because even if they have a proxy, how are we going to know, or how is that person going to know what you really want? So they want you to fill out, in the general world, you go to a lawyer, you go to the hospital, they give you a form. I want to have a DNR put into place, which means that if, God forbid, I stop breathing and I'm not going, if I'm in a situation where I will be able to fully recover, please let me recover. Do not put in a DNR, but please resuscitate me. A DNR means do not resuscitate. But if I'm in a situation where my health is already compromised, if I'm in a state of dementia, or I'm in a state of where I've had a stroke and there's significant damage, don't resuscitate me, just let me go. Okay, you check that off. Then they want to know, do you want to be intubated? Do you want to be put on a ventilator if you can't breathe? Okay, I want it in this situation. You want dialysis? Do you want a feeding tube? Do you want surgery? Do you want this, that, and the other? 50 choices that you pick out. Now, people fill this out at the age of 40 years old. They go to a lawyer. How in the world could anyone make decisions like this when everything is well? There are so many factors that are involved in this decision, halakhically, practically, socially, personally. How could you make a decision when you're 40 years old as to what you want when, God forbid, something happens? Certainly when you're 20 years old or 22 years old. So therefore, the RCA and the Aguda both came up with a form that they call the Advanced Medical Directive or the Halakhic Living Will. And that means that what you do is really very brilliant. What you do is you say, I want so-and-so to be my proxy, so I have the power to make decisions. That person has the power to make decisions for me. And then I want all medical questions that need to be decided to be decided by Rabbi X, Y, or Z. So if you're a Rabbi Bleich fan, you can put his name in. If you're a Rabbi Tendler fan, you can put his name in. If you're a Rabbi Herschel Schechter fan, put his name in. If the Rav of your shul is the person you ask all your shilas to, put his name in. Hopefully you'll be Rabbanim. Your names will appear on these things. But the idea is very simple. The answer is, rather than me telling you now what I want, which is ridiculous, I'm suggesting that this is a rabbi I feel comfortable with to make decisions for me because he sees life pretty much the way I see life. And therefore, he will know what the halakhic requirements are, what the guidelines are. Now, you as an individual can say on your healthcare proxy or to your rabbi or to your proxy and maybe to all of them, I don't want heroics. You know, whatever the halakha allows, I don't want to be alive more than the halakha requires. A person has a right to say, no, I want to fight for every last breath. I want to be on this world as long as God will allow me to use any machinery, any expense, any time, anything, any heroics. And the halakha makes the change. There are remoshes tshuvas, a person's in pain. They may have a right to say, I don't want this, I don't want that, under certain circumstances. A person says, you know, I can't live the way I used to live anymore. I no longer can play golf every Sunday and watch my favorite television shows, and I can't, whatever, do this, that, or the other. Life doesn't mean that much to me. You know, just put me into hospice and let say goodbye. You can't do that. That's basically suicide. A person has no right to do that. But within the parameters of halacha, there are variables where a person can say, I want everything done. A person can say, no, whatever is mutter within. And this is a very, very appropriate thing to do for everyone. So you need a halachic living will. The RCA or that one is formed. And by the way, those forms are almost identical. The only, I generally, I'm a member of both the RCA and the Agudah, so to me it makes no difference what you have. I do it for political purposes. But the point is that I recommend the Agudah will for only one reason. And that is because the Agudah will is written in 19 different forms based on the state in which you live. Some of them have slight differences in state requirements. There's one for Florida, there's one for Ohio, there's one for New York, there's one for New Jersey. The RCA living will is written in one form. And while it's good in most states, it probably, if it ever came, push came to shove, it might not be valid in some states. So it's worth doing them, and the approach is the same. There are almost no differences in terms of what the approach is. It's the same approach. Years ago when the RCA first did it, they did have a check-off system where it was much more broken down, and they decided it didn't make any sense, and they changed it to agree with the Agudah Will. So basically they're the same. So whichever one it is, and if you have a shul where Agudah is not going to fly, use the RCA. No problem. It's certainly better than anything else. And if you don't, if you have, I would recommend, especially if you're out of town, out of New York, probably worthwhile using the Agudah Will. Okay? But either one is fine. So that is something you should be aware of, and it's something you should encourage your community to do. Okay. Let's talk about someone in your community is terminally ill. We'll talk about what is a goses. Now, I will just very, very quickly, just in light of our previous conversation, I would just mention that hospice 15 or 20 years ago was seen as something that Orthodox Jews did not touch, did not get involved with, because the goal of hospice in those days was basically to let the person die. So when they reached that point and they went into hospice, it usually meant that there was no longer any food, meaning any nutrition or any hydration or any liquids given to the person. Basically, the person was left to starve to death. Okay, in other words, the person is in an advanced state of dementia, and the person is in an advanced state of, had a stroke, they're possibly brain dead or very brain dead or already brain dead, but they're breathing on their own, whatever it might be, to whatever level it is, just stop feeding them, let them go peacefully. That was the hospice approach. Halachically, that was not acceptable, according to almost every posek. Therefore, hospice, today hospice is a good idea. In fact, tomorrow morning I am speaking at Calvary Hospice, which is my recommendation probably as the best hospice in the New York metropolitan area. And I'm speaking together with Rabbi Mordechai Willig. I'm just introducing the morning. Rabbi Willig is giving a shiur on what Rabbanim need to know about medical issues. I don't know if you're allowed to attend or not. Maybe ask them if you can show up. It would be very worthwhile. They serve breakfast and lunch too. And I can get to see you guys again. But the point is that this is tomorrow. So hospice today is a good thing. Sometimes it can extend people's lives very meaningfully and certainly make the last months or weeks of their life much, much more comfortable. So there is room for hospice. You should know that. But what's very important is to know which hospice and to make sure that the hospice will not only accommodate requests that are religion-based, but will be comfortable with it and will encourage it and will make it easy for people who have to make those decisions based on halacha. Because there are hospices that if you push them and if you know the right questions to ask and if you're going to insist, they'll do it. But that's not, they're going to try to work around that as much as possible. There are hospices that are much better than others. As I said, Calvary, because it's run by the church, okay, who has a very similar belief in extending life that we do, therefore it's really, I've just learned about this in the last few months, and I've joined with them for no other reason than I really believe that I will have this course of recommending people to this hospice where their life will be extended for as long as possible in the most comfortable possible way. So to me, that's worth it, okay? So we're joining tomorrow, we're having this breakfast to encourage Rabbanim to come and to learn and to see what Calvary has to offer, okay? Yeah?
You know, Kohen will
go there.
What? Can a Kohen go there tomorrow?
It's a very good question, and the answer is, I'll give you a phone number that you can call tomorrow morning, and Rabbi Rachmiel Rothberger, who's a graduate of this yeshiva, I don't know if you know him, is one of their chaplains. They, by the way, have 3 full-time chaplains, and he gave me a number that you could call that tomorrow for Kohanim to find out if they can go. So call my office later, I'll give it to you. It's not the number that, you know, let me give you the number that he has. that I have for him, and but he may not answer it. If you need it, call my office tomorrow, and they will get, or, because this number is his personal cell, but he has another number. He gave it to me yesterday, I just don't have it on me. It's 347-804-6249. That's his personal cell. And if you want to, on some of the things that are handed out, there are numbers to how to reach my office. Any one of these things has numbers in the back of it. Okay, the gray one does, and this one does. At least those two have numbers. You can call my office, and they will give you a number where you could reach him. Okay, just make sure they give you a 646 number for Rabbi Rothberger, and that'll be it. Or try to reach him through Calvary directly. Okay, now, just wondering, I actually have a... I have a copy of, I didn't think I'd do it, I remember I took it last night with me. It's a copy of the invitation. I only have one. You can take a look at it later, and you can get the address if you're interested. Now, but make sure to let them know, because they'll make sure to have breakfast for you. Now, let's move on. Terminal ill patients go into a category at some point called a gosace. And you need to be aware of it. A gosace means the person is about to die, and it's irrevocable. Basically, rov gosis and lamisa, that's the halacha. And when a person reaches that stage, it usually, the way it is defined, and it seems I once heard a share from Rabbi Herschel Schefter where his understanding of gosis, the gosis could be walking around and being very active. But lamisa, the halacha, as it's generally defined, is a person who is, every breath is labored. You can tell that every breath might be their last. If they're on machinery, you'll see that it's fluctuating, their pressure is dropping. That's a gosis. Okay? And the halachas of a gosis are that we don't touch them. We don't do anything to touch them, because the fear is that if we touch them, that touch might be what, just that sudden reaction, they're so weak that will be the end and will shorten their life. So the halacha is a gosis should not be touched. If there's a clock that's ticking, we don't stop the clock from ticking, because that change might be enough to actually make the person die. That's not law of the God. We also don't bang things, don't make loud noises. We can sit. Now, if it's something that is for the benefit of the person, for example, you want to give them something because their lips are dry or something like that, or they need medication, then there are teirim how to do it, but you do it very gently and very carefully and so on and so on. But there are halachas of goses. You should be aware of it. The shear is not on goses. You can take a look in Hilchos Bikur Cholim, and you'll find the halachas of goses. Okay?
I was curious. Medically speaking, you can touch the person like a nice soft touch.
Something medically speaking, the halacha here is beyond the medical scope. Okay. But the halacha of goses is very clear. And there are shilas that are asked, but if a goses needs to be changed for cleanliness purposes, to be turned, there are heterim. You'll discuss those shilas. There are things that have been written about goses. Take a look at Rabbi Steinberg's Sefer on goses, the Nishmas Avram. There are a lot of svarim that deal with it, and you can find a lot on it, but you should be aware that it exists. Another thing that you should know is when a person, before they reach the stage of goses, a person is very sick, there's an inyan for a rav to say vidui with them. Vidui is an unbelievable thing. A person can do averis their entire life, and they say vidui, they're zochet to a certain level of tshuva. They have a chelek b'olam haba. And it's a very, very important thing to do. Now, if a person is at a stage where they cannot say vidui because they can no longer talk, you can say vidui with them. You hold their hand, and even if the person is maybe together, goses, just very gently hold the hand, and Chazal tell you what to say. In other words, we don't want to say, you're going to die, because that's not very helpful. Okay, and you're worried about touching them and they might die. You tell them that they might die. Okay, and so that's something we want to do, and it's also going to cause them tsar, certainly. So the halacha is you start out by telling them, harbe nisvadu velobes. Many people say vidui, it's going to be a schus for you. You're asking Rabbi Shalom to forgive you. That's a schus. Maybe that'll help you get better. Okay, and many people never said vidui, and unfortunately, they still passed on. So let's say vidui. If you could hear me, follow along. And if they could say it, matova manoyim. So let's talk about vidui. Now, when you're dealing with people who are not firm, and you start talking to them about, you know, coming at this stage of their life, and you're talking about, you know, why don't you repent? Why don't you do tshuva? People who never did tshuva, they never went to shul in Yom Kippur. Okay, now you're going to ask them to do tshuva at the end of their life. It's very strange. I'll tell you what I do, and this is my own. If I'm wrong, it's my mistake. But I'll tell you what I do. When I have a situation like this, I sit down with a person, and I say, you know, we've been through life is a very long time. And there are a lot of situations in life where we might be angry. We might feel we were given a raw deal. And there are many times in life we might have done something that might have made God angry. You know, you're not well. As Hashem, you'll get better. But it's a time where maybe you should think seriously about just making peace with God. You know, why don't you, at this point, just accept that whatever you were given in life was a gift, and accept the fact that at this point it's time to forgive, and ask God to forgive you as well. And by doing that, I found that to be a very, very, very positive way of approaching it. I mean, you have to know the person, and you can do it. If a person is from you, you don't need to go through all that. You just talk to them about doing, saying vidui. And very often they will respond. I mean, there's a story, and I'll just tell it very quickly because it has a lot to learn from. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But there was a man in my shul who was a I wouldn't say a Holocaust survivor. He came in before the Holocaust, but he was a butcher by trade. He was a member of my shul. He was actually the gabbai of my shul. Didn't read Hebrew very well. He used to make a mishaberach. He would curse the person. The words he would use was unbelievable. I mean, how did this guy figure out to say these words? You know, normally, the nusach of a mishaberach is lachlima l'rapoisei lachzikoi lachayoisei, right? He used to say lachlipoi l'rapoisei lachlikoi lachayoisei. How he figured out, like, every single one was a disaster. Was unbelievable. But then whatever it was, he was a really nice man. He was a Jewish man. He had one of those Busser kosher stores from the olden days. You know, that had simple kosher meat. How kosher it was, I don't know. But he was a good man. And he had a stroke. And his wife, it was his second wife, and his son would fight in the room over his Yerusha. What they're going to do when he dies. Okay? And I would say to them on a number of occasions, what are you doing? He's here. His wife would say, Eshen Tate, he's dead already. Now this was before brain death was the doctors told her he's brain dead. This was in the 70s, okay? It was in the late 70s. So anyway, one night I'm in the room, and while I'm there, they call a code on this guy. Everybody came running. This was before DNRs. They tried to resuscitate him, and they resuscitated him. And, you know, finally registered. I never attended a class like this, and I said to myself, Rabbi Zon, it's time for you to say vidui with this man. So I ran back home, and I got my rabbi's madrich, my manual, and I sat down with him, and I took his hand, and I said, Julius, I used to speak to him in Yiddish. And I said to him, you know, I went and said, you know, vidui, don't get nervous. Many people say vidui, and they recover. And this man had been in this situation for at least 2 months. I can only tell you that the grip that he gripped my hand with when I said that to him was so powerful. He was a very powerful man. He was a butcher, like I told you. This was 2 months after he'd been in this coma. He gripped my hand with such force that the thought that went through my mind was, you know, I was a Chevra Kadisha guy, the thought that went through my mind was, if he dies now, they're going to have to take a saw and cut off his hand because there's no way I'm going to get my hand out of this. Okay? I mean, that was the thought. That was how powerful it was. He kept that grip until I finished saying vidui. There's no question in my mind that he heard every word that I said. Okay, so when you come in and you visit people and they're in a coma and you think, never assume that they can't hear, because I can tell you from my own, this is one experience I had that was clear. And I must say, he died a couple of days, and this was right after a code. I don't know, maybe that woke him up. I don't know. But the fact is that he was fully aware of what I was saying. The point is, so you could say vidui. What do you say? The ikur vidui is yihi ratzon shetehei misasi kapora al kol avinoisai. That is the ikur lashon of vidui. And that with that you're mekayim vidui. Of course, if you could say more, you could say oshamnu, bagadnu, you could say whatever it is. Now, what if you're saying vidui with someone who can't repeat after you? Do you say yihi ratzon shetehei misascha? Do you say misasi? Anybody want to take a guess? Misasi, because it's Shemaya Kohana. Shemaya Kohana. He's listening, so it's like he's saying it. So you say it. The only thing you should not say is Yirotzen Shetei Misascho Kapor Al Kol Avonai Sai. I don't think that would be fair. But if you just, but other than that, it should be L'chatkil. It should be in the first person. Okay, so that's that. All right. Say vidui to someone. When a person dies, we generally ask them to be mochalas for anything that that we might be doing at this point. Okay? There are minhagim. The minhag is to say tehillim. By the way, for a goses as well, when you're in the room, to have people saying tehillim is appropriate. To have people there at the time of yetzias neshama is a very big zechus for the person. Okay? And a big comfort to the neshama. But there's also a minhag to light candles, even before a person dies, in the room where there's a goses to light candles, but certainly when a person dies, to light candles in that room. If there's oxygen, you have to be careful. You don't want a lit candle where there's oxygen. Okay? And there are all kinds of halachas when a person dies. When a person is pronounced dead, and by the way, when a person dies in a house, you need to have someone who is either a doctor or a policeman or a nurse, someone who is qualified to pronounce the person as having died. Because otherwise you'll call a funeral director. If no one pronounced the person dead, they are not permitted by law to remove them. So therefore you have to make sure that there's someone there to pronounce, whether it's police or Hatzalah or EMT or whatever it might be. Now, when a person is pronounced dead, note the time. When a person stops breathing, note the time. The difference between when a yard site is can be a minute. If it's before Shkia or after Shkia. You want to make sure, and even you know, a minute or two after Shkia, we generally count the next day. So therefore you should really note when they stop breathing. If they're going to work on them for a half hour and try to resuscitate, if they never do, then the time would be when they stop breathing the first time. If they bring it back, then it would change that. But just so you understand, important to determine the time of death. There is a minhag to place a person who died on the floor. It's called a hashgava, and the main reason is because the floor is the coolest place in the room. That's the main reason. There are other reasons, Kabbalistic reasons, but the main reason is to keep the body cool. And years ago, when there was no refrigeration, we were very concerned about keeping the body cool. There are other reasons. One reason is because it's similar to skila. We used to throw the person to the ground when they got skila, so we put the person on the floor. If he was needed skila, it's a mayain skila, it'll be mechaper in certain areas. There are different reasons the floor is not a kabel tuma. There are all kinds of reasons. But the fact is that there is such a minhag. However, when a person stops breathing, the minhag is other to pronounce him, or if you're going to try to revive him, but once a person you know is dead, the minhag is not to touch them for 20 minutes or a half hour. Not touch them at all. And the reason is because there's a chash, there's a fear that there might still be some vestige of life, and you don't want to extinguish that even for a second. So therefore, 20 minutes, half hour, the person does not breathe. At that point, we can definitely assume that they are dead, halachically. Okay? So there is such a minhag to do it. All right? Now, if they're in a hospital, chances are they're on a monitor and it's flat lines, the nurse is going to come in, they're going to do it, you can't really stop them. But for yourself, you should follow this minhag. Even after the nurses, you know, say he's dead, she's dead, you should wait.
In the hospital, you can't do this thing.
What?
In the hospital, you
can't put on. Well, if it's in a private room, I've done many hashgavas in hospitals. If it's in a private room, they will generally not have any problem with it. The main problem is that the people next door, you're in a room sharing with other patients. You don't want to terrify the other patients. But the point is, other than that, there's no reason why they won't allow it, but that's the reason. So there's a minhag of hashgava. There are other minhagim. There's a minhag to open the windows. There's a minhag to pour out any water that is in not only the room where the person died, but that in that entire house. Or if you're in the hospital, the room that they're in, the next room, the room on the other side. So even if there's a patient next door, in the next bed, I as a chesed would take, because it's a sakana, it's brought down, it's a sakana, I would take the water and empty it and fill up more water and give them new water. But there is an inyan to pour out water that's in the house. Now it's only water that's open. If you have closed bottles of water, it does not apply. It does not apply to soda. It does not apply to any other liquids. It's only water. Okay, yes?
If I'm not mistaken, in some places, maybe Shulchan Aruch, it says neighborhood?
In the shchuna. The minhag is only in that house, okay? There's time, if you're in an apartment and the people on either side are frum, I would probably say the apartment on either side. But that's as far as it goes, okay? Now, so that's a minhag. On Shabbos, there are those who are megal, that you don't have to do this on Shabbos because Shabbos is megan. There are all kinds of things, but let's stick to the ikur minhagim. The other thing is you close the eyes. There's an inyan for the oldest son to close the eyes, or at least a son to close the eyes. It comes from a pasuk in next week's parsha, where Hashem promises, actually it's in last week's parsha, where Hashem promises, it's in this week's parsha. Hashem promises, no, it's by Yigash, where Hashem promises Yaakov that if he goes to Mitzrayim, V'yosef yoshes yodai aleinecha, that he will close your eyes. That's where we learn this minhag from, that's where it comes from. It seems that that's a covet, and so we do it if at all possible. We also straighten the limbs. A person after death should always be lying with their face up. The minhag is that as soon as we're able to cover them, we cover them as lightly as possible. We want to keep them as cool as possible, but you cover them from the face way over the entire body, including the face, is covered, okay? The mouth should be closed, the eye should be closed, the mouth should be closed, the limbs should be straightened, and if you're doing a hashgavah, you can do that. The head should be raised, so if they're lying flat on the floor, put a pillow under them. If they're on a hospital bed, you could crank it up so that the head is higher, but the head should be raised higher than the rest of the body. Yes? On Shabbat, the minhag is, there are different shittas. Our minhag is that we do not do any of these things on Shabbos. Okay? If there's a guy there, an aide, that she wants to, he or she wants to close the eyes, I would not stop them, only that specifically. Otherwise, I would just basically let them wait till after Shabbos, unless we're going to have to remove them on Shabbos, which is another issue altogether. If a body is in danger of decomposing, you're in a tenement, and it's the radiators are blasting and you can't turn them off. So if it's the winter time and you can open windows and move the bed close to the window, that's what I would do. But if there is a situation where it's a boiling hot place and the air conditioning isn't working, you're in Arizona in the middle of the summer and the air conditioner is out and there's no way to get the place cool, you can move the person on the floor for Shabbos, so you can even go and ask a guy to come and move them, because things that are the Rabbanon were mutter for covered hames. So mukta was mutter. If we have to move a person to the ground, the halacha is you do it with a davar hamutter, so you minimize the iser of mukta. So what's brought in halacha is with a child or a kikar, you go and put a challah or a baby on the nifter and move it to the ground. I wouldn't suggest you go to your next door neighbor and say, can I borrow the baby? But you have to move. It's not a good idea. But the point is, and you don't have to use a challah, as long as it's something that is recognizable that it doesn't belong there, okay, and therefore you're moving it as a davar hamutter together with the nifter, that's all that counts. So if you want to fold up a towel or fold up or use a sefer or something else, that's obvious, that's fine as well. Okay, very important. We've talked about the person dies and now you are taking care of their needs. Never forget that there are living people, there are family members who are interested in this person. Someone just lost a husband, a wife, a parent, a child, a sibling, doesn't matter, a friend. Don't forget that there are available. So while your first concern to some extent is to put into place the things that the nifter needs, never lose sight of the fact, as a rav, you have to balance and you have to juggle many things. But in this time, you have to juggle. I always say the difference between us and the secular world is that when a person dies, the secular world focuses on the living, forgets about the dead, because the dead are dead, right? Doesn't matter at this point. We focus on what do the living need, and the funeral can take place a week later, and there's they have to do what they have to do, and then they wake the body, and they could feel a little better. They all look at him, they make him up to look beautiful, and so on and so forth. That's not the way our focus is for our care. Immediately, we have to focus on taking care of the person like we started off by saying that we buried immediately. Okay, but at the same time, as a Rav, you must be sensitive to the needs of the person. Help them, guide them, be sensitive to the fact that they just lost someone. Don't ever forget that. Now, you're going to meet with a family after a person died. Now, let's put it this way. Someone died, let's say it's in a hospital. Let's use a few different scenarios. We'll spend a few minutes on this. A person died in a hospital. Generally, there is a death certificate that gets signed by the doctor. A death certificate is a legal document that explains why the person died, so that people don't just die and they pull them out. We don't know what they died from, but who cares? Now we got to bury them. Maybe somebody injected poison in them. Maybe they were mistreated. Who knows what the reason is? That's not how it works. You have to have a death certificate with a plausible cause of death, or else the medical examiner gets involved and examines why the person died. Okay? Now, if the person if it's in a hospital, usually the doctor will sign the death certificate. Okay? If it's in a house and the person's in hospice, or the person has an aide and they're under a doctor's care, you should know which doctor to call and to make sure that they are willing and ready and able to sign the death certificate. The person might have had a flu and shouldn't have died, or there's no real reason, even though they have a doctor, but the doctor may say, look, I don't really feel I can say why they died. Just one second. Hello? Who's this? Please call my office. I'm in the middle of giving a shiur. Okay, I'm sorry. Call 849-9700. All right? Call me later. Okay? Yeah, not a problem. Thanks a lot. Okay. Now, so in the house, if a medical examiner has to do it, now in today's world, most cases may actually be referred to a medical examiner. And that means only that the medical examiner has to be called and signs off on it. In other words, if a person, the doctor, in many states where a person dies in the house, automatically the medical examiner must be called. Because they want to hear from the police who are on the scene, from the doctor, that this person died for a good reason, that there's no chash, no concern of any foul play, of any malpractice, and those kinds of things. Okay? So just because a medical examiner has to get involved doesn't mean autopsy is coming. Just know that that's something you should be aware of. And the sooner you put these things into motion, the sooner you call the doctor and say the person has died, the faster the process begins. So you need to know that that might be the first call, even before you call family members, other family members, and inform them they may have to sit with them, they have to go. Just get the process moving, and then you could do things that will speed up the process. Especially, be sensitive to time. Time is extremely important in terms of knowing what to do. Because if it's 6 o'clock in the morning, it might make a difference of what you put into motion to know if there could be a Leviathan that day. If you wait until 8 o'clock and you need a certificate, there are burial societies. We talked about them before. In New York City, very often, if the person had a grave that was part of a burial society, in order to be buried, the society has to give a permit saying that, yes, this person has a right of burial in this grave. Okay? And other than that, you can't bury. So if you don't call that person till 8 o'clock in the morning, that person might have just left for work. And now you're not going to reach them until 9:30 or so, or maybe 10 o'clock. They might have gone to a meeting. Okay? That could delay the Leviathan for a day, okay? These are the things to get into motion. You need to know that there's going to be a death certificate signed. You need to know if the person has a grave and whom to contact to be able to get permission to be buried in that grave. And then you can move on to other things. A funeral home, discuss which funeral home, because there are some funeral homes, if you call them after 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, they say, sorry, we can't do it today. Okay? So the earlier you get to them, the more likely you'll be able to get a funeral today. So those are the things that really need to get into motion. And by the way, we're going to talk about this, hopefully we'll get to it a little later. One of the groups that you need to work with as a rabbi is a Chevra Kadisha. And you need sometimes to train the Chevra Kadisha to know what they need to do first, second, or third to sensitize them to the fact that they need to be able to respond in order to get a kfura that day and be able to get a team together, even if a levaya, if a person isn't released till 9 o'clock in the morning, maybe they can get a team together, she can have a levaya by 1 o'clock. You know, the larger the city, the more likely this is possible. But again, these are things that you can work on and try to help the Chevra Kadisha become more effective, more efficient, more knowledgeable, more productive, and so on and so forth. Because ultimately, it all leads to greater Kavod Hames for the people in your community. The more they are prepared, the more knowledgeable, the more they know to have a grave, to have the information available, whom to call for the grave, to know what they're doing. These are all things that make a difference when, chas v'shalom, somebody dies, okay? So if it's in a house, you have to certainly reach out to a doctor, if a person was under a doctor's care. If you may need to get someone into the house to pronounce the person. In many states, there's a requirement to call the police, and the police pronounce, and they will reach out to the doctor, and so on and so forth. Some places, it's not the law. You should be familiar with that, okay? We talked about priorities. If it's a Shabbos or a Yontif, my recommendation is that when a person dies, we try to leave them, if at all possible, in the house over Shabbos or even over Yontif. Okay, if it's not that much time that the person is going to possibly decompose, if the room can be kept cold enough for the person to be placed on the floor, and it's going to be 6 or 8 or 10 hours, whatever, even a day, if it's cool enough, you can leave them there till after Shabbos. But if you have a situation, even on Shabbos, where it's going to decompose, then there are heterim to have a guy call a funeral home, a guy in a funeral home to come and pick up, and so on and so forth. There are heterim for that, okay? Now, as a general rule, though, we leave people there on Shabbos, on Yantav Sheni. If it's a 2 or 3 day Yantav, on Yantav Sheni, of course, this is also more kal. You can have someone pick up, especially if it's a 3 day Yantav. You're not going to leave a body in the house for 3 days. Yes?
How long does the body differ?
It's a very tough question because there are a lot of variables. It depends on whether the person was taking certain medications, if they were on oxygen. All oxygen will hasten decomposition if they were on oxygen. If they are diabetic, it will hasten the deterioration. If the room is warm, if they're overweight, it'll usually do that. There are a lot of variables. It's a very complex situation. Okay, very complex. You need the doctor who's there who will pronounce. You might want to ask him, and you want to know the truth. Many doctors don't know. The Chevra Kadisha people in the community might know. Okay, but as a general rule, over a day, if the room is kept fairly cool, 60 degrees or lower, a body will not decompose that quickly. Okay? So that's basically it. Now, that is when someone dies. We've talked about the minhagim that have to be done at that time. We've talked about the practical issues, being aware of time, differences between a hospital and a nursing home. The hospital will sign a death certificate. A nursing home, usually the doctor will sign a death certificate. In a house, you have to reach the doctor, and you have to have someone pronounce, and you have to call someone, very often the police. They will call the doctor, they will navigate with the medical examiner, and to know that a medical examiner does not always mean autopsy and so on. Okay? Now, we're going to come back to this a little bit later, but let's just talk about preparing the family for a levaya. Now, first of all, even from people, don't always know what goes on at a levaya. They've never dealt with it. They dealt with it 40 years ago when grandpa died, or they dealt with it, they were totally tzimish. There was someone 10 years ago, but they were in a state of shock. They don't know what to do. So you have to make the assumption that they need your guidance. I would meet with the family, preferably at home, preferably go in and talk to them, meet with them, go through what the levaya will be like. First of all, when the levaya will be. I would make a very strong recommendation. Every Rav in their shul, part of Parshas Vayechi, part of educating the community, in your shul bulletin, chas v'shalom, somebody passes away, your number should be the first number they call. The first person to be called is you, unless you have a very strong Chevra Kadisha, and they will call the Chevra Kadisha, who will then call you, know to call you. But the Rav, you don't want them calling you and saying, Rabbi, we set the funeral for 12 o'clock, we hope you can be there. Hey, you want to be there to tell them when to set the funeral time. Okay? You want to be there to guide them. Maybe they're going to call you Samurai. We're having it tomorrow because that's what the funeral director said. You want to be able to talk to them because you might tell them, what do you mean tomorrow? Why can't you do it today and push the funeral director to do it today? Okay? There's a big picture. So you want to train your community to know that they want you to be involved immediately. And you want to then sit down with them, discuss with them, obviously to counsel them, to give them a chizuk, to give them strength, to talk to them about, you know, just to give them someone to lean on, all of that, of course. But then you also want to tell them what to expect at Levaya. Who's going to speak? It's Rosh Chodesh. We don't speak. What can we do? What should we do? Where is the Levaya going to be? Is it going to be at a funeral home? Is it going to be at the cemetery? If only five people are coming, why do we go to the funeral home? Sometimes having a Levaya at a funeral home where 20 people are going to show up, okay, to the funeral home, you get to the cemetery, there are three people there. Okay, there's no one, not a minion to say Kaddish, there's no one to help fill the grave. If you would have had the Levaya at the cemetery, you would have had the same 20 people at the cemetery, and you could have said Kaddish, and you could have filled the grave, and it would be a much bigger covet for the person. So you have to figure out where is the best place for Levaya. All of these things are things that you need to put into place really right away. So think in those terms, prepare the family for the Levaya. You have a family that's not frugal. They know that the last time they were at a funeral, the funeral director came out with his ribbon. Nothing. They don't know about Kriya. Kriya, that's old-fashioned. At Levaya yesterday. Sunday. At Levaya Sunday. Okay? Family was totally not from. What? How did I get to do this Levaya? I don't do Levayas as a general rule. I don't take Levayas because it puts me in a very compromised position with the funeral directors. I take them to task sometimes. If they were calling me for funerals, and I was making a lot of money on it, it would put me in a very difficult position to have to fight them. Okay? So I don't take advice. But this happened to be that the nephew is a guy, it was a Baal Tshuva that I know, and he said, my great aunt died. She died in Florida. They're shivering her up. She was at a Geisha funeral home. I helped get into a Jewish funeral home here. She's being shipped to New York. By the time we found out, she was ready and embalmed, but she had a tahara. Everything worked out as best as possible in the circumstances, and I agreed to do the Levaya. But I spoke to the children the night before. There were two sons. And I said, why don't you wear a shirt that you don't mind cutting? Okay? The halacha is you should cut a jacket and a shirt. For a parent, it's ad halei if you do both. But at least a shirt, or Maisha holds a shirt, is the ikar begin. So at least that, and let them be mekayim, the mitzvah of tearing kriya for a parent. It's a schus for the parents, it's a schus for them. So one son said fine, and the other son came from Sweden. He said no. Okay? But at least one son did. So prepare them. Not only for them, you have four people. They're not thinking kriya. They show up to the funeral with their best suit they just bought for Pesach 2 weeks ago, and now they're going to be cutting that suit. Why? Talk to them the night before and tell them, wear an old suit. Okay, it's an Indian of Kriya. No Indian tearing Kriya on the hush of the suit that you have. Okay, so those are the kind of things you can, just as a chesed, let them know what to expect. Are there enough people to carry the urn, to lower the urn, to fill the grave? Who's going to be maspid? What is a hesped? How do you say a hesped? Tell you get up, and all they can say about Grandma is, she was the funniest lady. She would talk like a sailor. I mean, wonderful. That's a big covet to her to get up and talk about the fact that she cursed like a sailor. But that's what they do. You go to funerals today, and that's what they say. Grandma, she was wicked. She was hip. Okay? She knew how to make, kasha varnishes. Well, is that all you can say about Grandma? Grandma was a wonderful woman who raised a wonderful family, who helped people all the time. She was a good person, a kind person, a friendly person, a believing person, an accepting person. There's a million things that Grandma could have been. They don't talk about that. So talk to them about what are appropriate things to say. Inspire people. Okay, about what Grandma did. She came from a different world, a different generation. She adapted. Whatever it is, talk to them. Okay? Talk to them about the Levaya, as I said. What will be at Levaya? Who will speak? Who will carry? All of those things. Where should the Shiva be? There's a halacha that Shiva should be preferably where the person died. Or if the person died at home. Or even where they lived if they went to the hospital. But that's where the Shiva should be. Because we believe that the Neshama is there for the Shiva at the place that they died. Okay, so where should you sit shiva? Should you move around? One day I'm going to sit here, one day I'm going to sit there. One day I'm going to sit in my neighborhood, one day I'm going to sit with my sister, one day with my brother. There are all kinds of things people do. People sit shiva today for 3 days. The reform, that's all they sit in, it's for 3 days. The funeral I had on Sunday, they were both going home. One was going back to Florida, one was going to Sweden. They sat shiva. That afternoon was the shiva. It was over that night, they're flying out. Okay? What could you do? But you should at least tell them what the shiva is, talk them where to sit, how to sit, when to sit. These are all issues that you should be talking about with them. I would also suggest to make arrangements with them at the funeral home. If you're going to Shemri Hadassah in Borough Park, you may not have to worry. If you're part of the Yeki community here, okay, you may not have to worry because they have a set deal and everybody gets buried the same way. But if you're out in Oshkosh, okay, or in Fort Lauderdale or wherever you might be, you don't know which funeral home they're going to sit with. They're going to sit with a funeral director who's going to talk them into a $7,000 casket, okay, and maybe into a mausoleum, or who knows what they're going to talk them into, okay? You want to be there for the arrangement so you can properly guide them. Or, as we'll talk about later, work something out with the funeral home in your community so that your shul has an agreed-to package. The family doesn't even have to go into the funeral home. Anybody that dies in this community, this is what we do. They come to the funeral and pay the bill. But there's no sitting down with them and offering them casket A, B, C, or D, okay? Or ribbons or a Kriya knife. There's a set standard. What?
Ribbons.
Not from people wear ribbons, okay? They wear a little ribbon with a little hook on it that hooks onto the thing, and they tear them, they cut them, they do them, whatever it is. That's what it is. It's the reform way of mourning. That's ribbons. In my shul, there were times where people didn't want to tear kriya. I told them, don't wear a ribbon. At least they're not over mechukaseh mitzvah. It's, you know, so they're not mekayim mitzvah. They're not over mechukaseh. So you have to know. But if you are there on the spot, you can guide them. So be there. That's the point. Making arrangements with the funeral home is part of something a Rav needs to do where families are required to come in and make arrangements. The Rav should be able to be there to guide them. Okay. Now we're coming to a section that where there are, this section is going to take a good part of the rest of the time, and I call this section Know the Players and the Problems. What I'm trying to do here is to explain to you who are future Rabbanim, who are the players that you're going to be dealing with in the community at the end of life, and what are the problems that exist with each of those players, okay, and how you could best navigate it and what you need to know. So let's talk about the first player, and the first player on the totem pole, I mean not on the totem pole, the first player on the list chronologically is the hospital. Okay, hospitals are places where very many people in your community are going to die. Okay, now, if there's more than one hospital, you may want to meet with more than one hospital. But first of all, you need to have a relationship with the CEO in your hospital. Now, in New York, you have Beker Chaim, and you have all kinds of different organizations that do all kinds of things for us. It's not as prevalent, but you go out of town, you're the man, you're the show. You really create what's going on. You can make your own situation. What are we worried about in the hospital? So first of all, you want to know that you may want to sensitize them to our view of life, which is really going a little further back, you know, about living, you know, respect life, healthcare proxies, okay, not to push people to die. Don't force them to sign DNRs and so on and so forth. Understand our perspective. Work with us. I am going to be the rabbi listed on many of my people's living wills, and I'm going to be helping them make decisions. Understand where we're coming from. Our view of sanctity of life may be very different than your view of quality of life. And you may have other considerations than we have. Please work with us and be sensitive to us. That's number one. Number two, someone died. Is the hospital going to be pushing this person to have an autopsy done? because they happen to have a disease that is only one in 150 people have that disease. And they'd like to do some research. Okay, so they're going to encourage them to have an autopsy. But you know what? That autopsy is really, they're going on a fishing expedition, but they're very good at making it sound like if you don't have this autopsy, people all over can be dying. You have this autopsy, and we're going to learn about this disease, and you're going to help humanity. Is that much a la-la-la? Pretty partial that it's not in most instances, okay? We're not talking about Legionnaire's disease that suddenly popped up and they needed to know what it was and what caused it, because there were people in the next bed. All these, I don't remember when Legionnaire's disease came out, it was basically at an American Legion conference in Philadelphia, and they literally learned from every case that they autopsied where the disease came from, and they eventually helped save lives. That might be mutter. That's a different story, but that's not what we're talking about. Are you connected to a hospital that is a teaching hospital? You're going to be pushing autopsies on our people. Know that we are, by religion, opposed to having an autopsy. What about organ donation? Well, some people are organ donors, some people are not organ donors. Okay? Question is where you stand on that. Then there are questions of which organs. The question is, will the hospital hold the person up, even if the rabbi says, no, this person is not an organ donor, but the family hasn't signed off on it, and now you're going to delay the funeral. There are hospitals today that will not release a body until a family comes in and signs a paper saying, we do not want the organs removed. Okay? There are a lot of ways in which hospitals can throw a monkey wrench into how things work. And then the most important thing, it's 11 o'clock at night. Is there going to be anyone to sign a death certificate at 11 o'clock at night so the body can be moved? So that a Leviathan can be had the next day. If they tell me, well, the doctor will be in at 9 o'clock in the morning, and if he hits traffic, it'll be 10 o'clock in the morning, and that's when we'll have the death certificate signed, and it's a Friday where Shabbos is at 4 o'clock. You're not going to get a funeral that day if you first start picking up the body. First of all, the Chevra Kadisha won't be able to do the Tahara. In many towns, the Chevra Kadisha will do the Tahara early morning or the night before, but once it's 10 o'clock in the morning, the Chevra Kadisha is at work. You're not going to get a group to do it. Now you're going to delay Leviathan till Sunday because the hospital wouldn't release the body. So they have to know that for us, getting a body released from the hospital is extremely important. Okay? Will the hospital expedite things? If the medical examiner has to be called, will the hospital make the call before 3 hours after the person died, when you're there to pick up the body and then suddenly you find out, oh, we have to call the medical examiner, and now it takes another 2 hours or 3 hours, and there goes Levi again. Okay? I mean, these are all things you want to develop a working relationship with a hospital. Know the issues, know the problems, know the people, have a relationship. It pays off. In the long run, it pays off. It may not need it more than once in 5 years, but when you do, it's a huge thing. And it usually will be more than that. And it's a good thing now, because then you'll need chas v'shalom intercession to get a doctor, to get a surgery on emergency. If you have a relationship like this, you can access all kinds of other things. So it's a tremendous matter. The next player is the medical examiner. And like I told you, the medical examiner does not always mean an autopsy. But again, the medical examiner has to sign off as quickly as possible and release the body as quickly as possible. Will they work with you quickly, understanding your needs? And will they accommodate, I hate to say it, a typical story. Someone overdoses. They were known to be addicted. They were known to have a problem. Will the medical examiner insist on an autopsy? Now, by law, they can in most states because that person died a traumatic death, a natural death. Or will the medical examiner say, like they will in many states where there is an accommodation, or if you have a relationship, say, look, we know what the story was. We know what it is. We'll draw blood so we can confirm that there was a high level of drugs in the body, and that will tell us the cause of death. But we're not going to force it. We're not going to force an autopsy. Okay? Those are the kind of things. Nebuch a Sitz case. Okay? A child that passes away 6 months. Okay? Doesn't wake up. This is an unfortunate situation. Now, what are they concerned about? Medical examiner is rightfully concerned. Maybe the child was neglected and abused. It could be. Okay? There are crazy people out there. But there are things that they can do that will not require an autopsy. For example, they can do a body scan, which will show if there was any bruises to the body. Okay, they can do an external examination, do a scan of the body, and even draw blood, which will show certain things. And if they're afraid, what they're most afraid of is a body that people shake children like, stop crying! Okay, and it can do tremendous damage. Okay, there is a test where they draw blood from the eye. They draw actually fluid from the eye, which indicates if there's any blood in that fluid, it means they were traumatized. Okay, those are the kind of things that we could work together with, and unfortunately, it happens. It happens. Yes.
But won't they have to wait until the results to sign the death certificate?
The results of an MRI are almost immediate.
No,
the results of no. So they won't do. They will generally, if the child looks like it was not abused, they will generally do it. And when the results come back, worse comes to worse, they'll exhume the body if they have.
Okay.
Yeah.
If they do draw blood or fluid, whatever, does that have to be collected by the rabbi to be buried with the mace?
No. Generally, that blood, generally, if it's for the purpose of covering our mace, generally we can be makel and not have to bury it with the person, okay? If there's an autopsy and there are organs that are returned weeks later after testing was done and so on, then we generally do try to bury those organs. We do try to get it back. There's a whole, one of the things I think I have in the package that you didn't get today is what we call traditional Jewish autopsy procedures, which is something that we worked with a medical examiner, which is really what we're talking about here, and that is if chas v'sholom, there must be an autopsy because it was a hit and run. Okay, which is a homicide. And a homicide is a federal law that requires an autopsy. You have to have an autopsy. They're going to do it. Then there are procedures that you can follow that will minimize the nivul hames, that will minimize the desecration of the body in certain ways. So the entire tahara, for example, entire autopsy is done in a pouch, so that if there's any blood that flows, it'll be contained in the pouch. All the instruments that I use are cleaned off from so the blood can be saved. We do a minimal amount that we have to do to prove what happened, okay? We leave all the organs in. We sew up the body as tightly as possible so that at least a body can be dressed in tachrichim and so on and so forth. On and on and on, a whole bunch of different things, okay? We ask to have someone in the room that can be there. There is a whole procedure. So those, again, are things. Know the medical examiner, know the laws in your state, have him or her know what your needs are for them, not at a time where you're head-to-head, eyeball-to-eyeball, under tremendous tension. Have them understand. I mean, it's a shame I don't have time, because there are phenomenal stories that, you know, where you've had these connections and relationships where you've saved families tremendous grief and tremendous tsar. So having that relationship is very, very, very helpful. The funeral director. Have a relationship with the funeral director in your city, and if there's more than one, get to know them all. There's no reason why you can't play the capitalist system and meet with each of the funeral directors and say, will you offer our community, our synagogue, a package? That means automatically there is a kosher box, automatically there's proper linen tachrichim, automatically there is going to be a funeral that day if possible, automatically you will not offer them ribbons, okay? You will make the assumption that they're going to tear a shirt or whatever it is, okay, or a blouse. Those are the things that you, and they don't have to come in to visit and to make arrangements. You're going to just do it over the phone because it's part of that package, and you'll reduce the cost because we'll send all our people here. No reason why you can't play that game and develop a package. It's great. And it saves your people the tsar of on a day that they lost X, Y, or Z, some relative. They don't have to sit with some Italian funeral director who's going to try to push all kinds of things on them that they don't need. Okay? Those are the facts. So you can do that. Get to know the funeral director. What are his issues? Will he accept a levaya at 9 o'clock in the morning and do it that same day? Okay? When I started in this business, if you called a cemetery at 9:01, they turned you away that day. If they called a funeral home at 7 in the morning, they would say we're too busy. Okay? That was just the way the world ran. Now, I'll tell you the best story I have. 1:45, I'm sitting and having lunch with a guy who runs the cemetery in Flushing. We're having lunch on Main Street on a Friday afternoon where Shabbos was about 4:45. And what happened, maybe it was 12:30, no, it was about 12:45. And I get a phone call from Parkside, which is a funeral home in Queens, and they said to me, Rabbi, will you still pick up a body from Brooklyn? The person died in a hospital on King's Highway, okay? Now it's called Beth Israel. At that time, I remember what it was called, it was a King's Highway Hospital, maybe. Whatever it was, on 34th Street and King's Highway, will you still pick up, because it's a few hours before Shabbos, will you still send people to the hospital? Our Chevron Ganesha sends Chevron people to actually pick up the body, so they're moved by from people, okay? I said, well, I'll tell you what, if they promise a death certificate by 2 o'clock, I'll do it. If not, I'm really not going to do it, because we'll hang them up. So he calls me back in 5 minutes. He says, no problem, they will have his death certificate in a half hour. Please send people right away. So I start arranging it, send people right away. I'm sitting there making the phone calls while these guys are sitting and waiting for lunch to be served, okay? And they're watching me, you know, and I'm going through this all these motions, okay? At 1:05, the funeral director calls me back. He says, Rabbi, this may sound strange. They want the funeral today. It's 1:05, Shabbos is 4:45, the body's in Brooklyn. And I'm sitting with the guy who managed, I said, where's the burial? Mount Hebron, right here, Main Street. I'm sitting with the guy from Mount Hebron. I said, Jerry, you're not going to believe this. You think your cemetery can still do a burial for this body today? Figure will be in by 3:30. Okay, it's right in the neighborhood, everything's close by. He says, let me call Adam. He says, if we can dig the grave by machine, it's yours. And we have that relationship. I can do this. It's unbelievable. I didn't believe it could be done. The body was moved from Brooklyn by a Chevron Kadisha. We had the body back in Queens by about 2:15. The Chevron Kadisha women were there waiting for her. Okay? The Tahara was done by 3:15. They were at the cemetery by 3:30. The family was out of the cemetery on their way home at 4 o'clock. And it's unbelievable. But of course, this was all very close. It just, the woman had a schus, obviously. It was meant to happen. But this is something that years ago you couldn't dream of. But still out in the smaller towns, funeral homes are not so ready to work with you and do a levaya that day. It means they have to turn themselves into pretzels to get it done. Well, one guy has to go file a certificate, another has to go, everybody has to get into motion. They might have to pay extra to hire outside staff to do certain things. It takes time. This is, you need to be able to talk to them. I'm not saying you should tell them this story, okay, because you'll terrify them. But the point is, but at least talk to them about what are your parameters? What can we expect when we want to work together, okay? So that's the funeral director. The Chevron Kadisha, you need to know your Chevron Kadisha, and you need to work on raising their standards, if that's necessary, giving them chizuk, that's always necessary. Recognizing them and what they do for the community, which is always necessary. Give them a sense of sadness. I know they all do it. It's a chesed shalem. Zayin Adar. Do a suda for them. Do something that gives them some sense of importance. Recognize them even without their names, whoever you are. Recognize them. Give them strength. Give them chizuk. Give them continuing education. It's one of the things our organization does, National Association of Chevron Kadisha. We are close to many, many chevrons across the country. Many places, every 5 to 10 years, I come in and I give refresher courses. There are new people. Things change in the business, okay? New medical procedures, new things that change, okay? New laws that change, things they should be aware of. Whatever it might be, work with them. Know there's a difference. There is a shul chevron kadisha in many communities, and then there are communal chevron kadisha in many communities, and sometimes both. A shul chevron kadisha will usually be just for your shul, okay, or for the other shul, okay. And well, then sometimes there's an overlap. Sometimes there's a communal chevron. When there are communal chevrons, you run into a problem because very often the people who are involved might be there from 50 years ago and are not Shomer Shabbos today because 50 years ago they couldn't get Shomer Shabbos people to do Tahara. Now the community has changed, there's a kollel in town and they're still running the Chevron Kadisha. And it because there's tension. Work on this. Try to improve the situation and the standards. Know the issues, know the players. Ultimately, it will provide greater service to your community, to your balabatim, and provide greater kavod hames. The cemetery. You know how many issues exist with cemeteries? Cemeteries are probably the most difficult people to work with. I used to hate cemeteries. I still hate cemeteries. Who likes cemeteries? I never liked cemeteries. But you know what I mean? As a Rabbi Avigdor Milievsky say, you get depressed, take a walk in the cemetery. You'll feel better. That was his line. But you know what I mean? Cemeteries have their place in life. They're necessary. But cemeteries are very difficult to work with. You know why? Because they have a captive audience. Where are you going to go? You have to go to the cemetery. Unless you want to get cremated, you've got no choice. There's a family plot. They got you over a barrel. They can charge what they want. They can create rules what they want. They can tell you when to come, how to come, where to come. They can make you crazy. So you need to know the cemetery in your community. Will they accept the Levaya at 9:01 or 10:01 or on a Sunday afternoon? What? There are cemeteries that are closed on Sundays. Open a dialogue with them. What kind of monuments do they allow? Will they allow people to fill the grave? Family cemeteries, especially out west, down south, we don't allow anyone to fill the grave. You can bring the thing, we'll lower the casket, you throw in a few traditional shovelfuls, we're going to fill it later. Why do they do this? Because they want to make sure that you don't break any bushes, no one's going to fall in and they're going to be sued. They have all kinds of crazy reasons. Okay, they'll tell you, of course, it's insensitive to the family to hear the thud of the earth on the casket. You know, whatever they'll tell you. But not every funeral, not every cemetery will cooperate with you. Will they allow upright monuments? Will they allow upright monuments in the entire cemetery, only in certain sections? I'm dealing now with a Rav, a very hush of a Rav. In fact, I think he's affiliated with this institution, where a member of his family is buried, and they did not realize that in this particular area of gray, of the cemetery, they only allow flat markers. They do not allow upright monuments. Right next door, three graves over, are upright monuments, but they're on the other side of the line. This is now a family plot, and they don't allow monuments in a family plot. They only allow flat markers. That's called a memorial park. Okay, why? Because they ride over it with their tractors. Okay, and the family's having tremendous tsar. So I'm trying to negotiate with a cemetery. Impossible. Okay? These are all things you need to address with your cemetery. You need to know your cemetery, what the issues are. Yes?
Is that a halachic or minhag issue or just a family preference?
It's a minhag issue. It's a halachic issue. Rechatchila, a kever, has to be a monument. It's supposed to be mitzayin the kever. It's supposed to outline the kever. So the best thing is likely to have an Eretz Yisrael where the grave is completely covered with a monument. That's the best, because then you know exactly where the kever is. But if you have a monument standing at the head of the grave, then at least you know that 6 feet in front and the width of the monument is where the person is buried. Okay, at least you understand that. But if you have a foot marker, just Sunday I pointed out to someone at the cemetery that if you see the foot marker is about a foot and a half into the grave. It's sitting over like the legs of the body. If you're walking in front of that, well, you're right on top of the body. It doesn't tell you where the grave is. Okay, it's also not the same width as the grave. So it's not mitzayin the kever. On top of that, you don't even see there's a kever. Some of them are so flat you can walk right on it and you'll not know you're walking on it. Okay, so there are in Florida, in California, you know, they call them memorial parks. The entire cemetery is just flat and they have rows of what they call family stones. They have a stone at the beginning of a section, and in front of that there's, you know, 50 just flat markers. Okay, it's beautiful. Cemeteries are beautiful, but it's not proper covered on mace. Okay, so these are all issues to know. The cemetery, will they open on holidays? How much time do they need to open? What are their charges? Will they help you with someone who's indigent? Well, a lot of my work has to do with mace mitzvah. People die. They're going to get cremated. They don't have a grave. Will they help? Will they help you get a grave reasonably? Will they reduce their grave opening charge if necessary? Okay? Will they work with you? Not every day, but maybe once in a few years. These are all things to discuss. Okay? Communication. Extremely important to be in communication with the family. You come in, you know exactly what to tell them, you know how to give them chizuk, you know how to listen to them, you help them set up the levaya, you help them do everything necessary. And now you walk out the door and something comes up because Antilly called with a problem, she can't come in, and you have no way of reaching you. Tremendous tsar. Your community, a Rav, needs to be able to be reached in emergency situations. There's got to be a way to reach you. And especially if you're already involved with a family, make sure you know how to reach them, make sure they know how to reach you, make sure you have the funeral director's cell number so that if he closes at 4 o'clock, you have a way of reaching him. Make sure you have communication, that your communication is as strong as possible. We talked about knowing the importance of time. Time is an extremely important element when dealing with all this, knowing when the time of death is, knowing what the time so that you know what your parameters are for having a Leviathan the same day. All of those things are extremely important. Let's talk about a modern day problem which exists, which is shipping. Many people are snowbirds. They move down to Florida for the winter time, and they unfortunately get sick and they pass away there. But their graves are here. Okay, or vice versa. They're living in Florida, they'd be buried in Florida, they're visiting the kids here and they pass away. What do you do? So first of all, I will give you a tremendous eitzah. The eitzah is, if a person is going to be buried in another location, and the funeral is going to basically be in another location, don't contact the funeral home here, where they died. Contact the funeral home where the burial will take place, where the funeral will take place, and let that funeral home arrange for the shipping of the person from the place they died. You will save the family money, more often than not time. It's just much easier. The question is, where does the tahara get done? Does the tahara get done where they died, or does the tahara get done where they're going to be buried? Okay? So you'll find in halacha there is a difference of opinion whether the tahara is done closer to death or closer to kvura. But that was in a time where there was a concern about decomposition. So the fear was that if you didn't do the tahara immediately when they died, they would decompose and you wouldn't be able to do a tahara. If the person is dead for a certain amount of time, the rigor mortis sets in, skin begins to slip. The process of decomposition really begins immediately and after a period of time. So that was a svara to do it right away. Okay? Today we have refrigeration. We have all kinds of ways to preserve a body. People are in general condition, better condition as it is. And therefore, it's really not necessary. The time is always better samoch l'kvura. And I'll tell you why. Because number one, if you do a tahara in New York, the body is being buried in Florida. In the shipping process, very often the tachrichim that a person wears get soiled. A person in the process of shipping after they're dead might very well, you know, there are gases that build up in the body just like the body decomposes, and when that happens, sometimes fluids may come out of the mouth and nose, it could be purging, it happens. The tachrichim will get dirty, especially in the flight process, the plane goes up, the plane goes down. It can very well happen. The body gets to Florida, and now it's filthy. By the time you bury it, the tahara has been done already, the body is being buried filthy. It's a big bizarre hames. A person should be buried with very clean tachrichim. Why? Because we believe that we appear ba'olam haba, the way we are lying in the kever. It's a covet to bury a person clean. There's tremendous emphasis in the tahara process to keep a body clean. But then there are much worse issues. Much worse issues. The shipping codes of most airlines is to require a pouch. It means the body is placed after the tahara in a plastic bag with a zipper. And it's shipped up in the box in that pouch. Now, if the tahara was done, there's a very good chance that body will be buried in that pouch because we don't open the box after a tahara. Family's frum. They don't realize that the body's in a pouch. If you don't take the body out of the pouch, it's basically the body might as well not be buried. It'll be in that pouch for the next 50 years and never decompose. Or it'll decompose, but it'll never return to the earth because it's lying in a plastic pouch that is not biodegradable. I have done disinterments 10, 15, 20 years after a person was buried and their entire body was still contained in the pouch because they never opened the pouch. So for that reason alone, and then the chevra could, and let's say they do take it out of the pouch, who's going to take it out? The Italian in Florida. And what if he sees that the tachrichim are dirty? Don't you think he's going to clean it? Because what if the family wants to look at the body and they're going to see the dirt? So now they're going to undress the body, redo the Tara. It's terrible. So the recommendation is always, on top of that, there's money involved. If you go to a funeral home in New York and say, someone just died, we need you to ship it to Florida. They pick up the body, they charge you for a pickup, they charge you for shipping, they charge... Their bill, even if they don't say, first of all, they're going to try to sell you the casket here, they're going to become what they call the primary funeral director. Then they're going to have to, and they're going to charge you a $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 bill. Then you're going to go to Florida, you still have to use the funeral home there, the funeral director has to pick it up from the airport, the funeral home has to use the funeral home for the funeral, they have to bring it to the cemetery, they're going to charge you another $5,000. They all figure out ways of charging you money. If you call the funeral home in Florida and all they have to do is ship it, there are a lot of shipping companies, they compete with one another, the entire shipping cost is under $1,000. Okay? So that's the just a good eitzah to know. And you should also be aware of the pouch issue. It's an extremely important issue that most people have no knowledge of. Funeral directors, I was sitting with a funeral director that we serviced a few days ago, and the question of pouches came up, and I said to him, I hope you remove all the pouches. And he smiled, didn't have to say anything. I caught right away that he doesn't remove bodies from pouches more often than not. If the family's going to do an ID, they will open the pouch and, you know, kind of push it to the side so nobody knows. And the body won't be zipped up. It will still be lying in the pouch. It's a tremendous bizarre amaze. It's terrible. So these are the issues that you should be aware of. So I always recommend just to repeat, I always recommend that bodies should be taharid at the place of burial. And of course, it's going on an assumption that there is a chevra kadisha at the place of burial. If someone grew up in Kalamazoo and they're being buried in Kalamazoo, okay, and there's no longer a chevra kadisha in Kalamazoo, obviously you have no choice but to do it here. But what I would do is to make sure that the funeral home in Kalamazoo or the rabbi there, wherever it is, will open the urn and remove the body from the pouch and make sure that they'll do that. I just had this conversation this morning with someone. Okay, a rabbi just called me from South Carolina, Rabbi Moshe Davis, literally on my way as I was leaving, about a similar question. Someone's being shipped up, what do I need to know? Okay, so that is an issue you should be aware of. Now, I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about Chevra Kadisha itself and what a Tahara is and what you need to know at a Levayim, okay, about the Chevra Kadisha itself. What does the Chevra Kadisha do? So, Chevra Kadisha come in all sizes and forms, they do all kinds of things, but let's start with the Mahadrin Min HaMahadrin. Let's talk about a 100% service Chevra Kadisha. The Chevra Kadisha will, number one, be with the body, take over from the time that a person dies. They will go into the place where the person dies, they will wrap the body appropriately, they will remove the tubes that need to be removed, leave the tubes that need to be left. As a general rule, you should know that if a person dies in the hospital with intravenous tubes, with catheters, with all kinds of things, our recommendation is leave everything in because of a few factors. Number one, some of those tubes, when you remove them, it bleeds. And even if they stop the bleeding, the tube has blood in it, and that blood should be saved. The rule is any kind of bodily fluids do not need to be saved, but blood is the one thing that does need to be saved. There are different categories of blood. Blood prior to death, we don't go through life saving every tissue from every nosebleed, right? We bury limbs. We bury a leg that's removed, but we don't bury blood. So blood before death doesn't have to be saved. Blood at the time of death that contributes to death, someone died in an accident and they're losing blood and they die, that blood needs to be saved under all circumstances. And even if we have to dig up earth and it's filthy and whatever it is, that's where Zaka comes in. That blood needs to be saved. It's called Dam Nefesh, we save it. There is blood that flows after death, which is mostly what Chevra Kadisha deal with, and that is blood that flows after death, okay, and doesn't contribute to death. There's a tube in the arm, but when you pull it out after death, there's blood in it. And the body died, and now there's blood that should be buried with the body. Blood is part of the body. That blood should be buried, according to most Shitas, And therefore, we recommend that everything stay inside the body, and the Chevra Kedisha will remove it and do what has to be done. So it's also when they remove it, sometimes it causes bleeding, and it bleeds afterwards. The Chevra Kedisha will get a body that's completely lying in a pool of blood because they pulled out one catheter that wasn't properly closed off. Okay? So these are the things that you should be aware of. Okay? So some Chevra Kedisha will actually start from the hospital or the house where the person died. They'll wrap the body and so on. Then there are Chevra Kedisha that will only provide a shomer at the funeral home. They'll provide shmira at the funeral home. There should be shmira of the body with the body as much as possible, okay, until the time of the burial. Now, shmira best should be in the proximity of the body, but at least if someone is even in the building, it's also a level of shmira. There are different levels. Okay, if a body's under refrigeration, does a shomer have to sit there and is he potter from davening, like the Gemara says in Brachas? No, because that person is not in danger of having animals attack them, okay, which is the main reason of Shmira. The Gemara's example is where if you walk away, rats will attack the body. There, you can't move away, even if it means you don't daven. But today, where it's alz kavod, you don't have to have that level of Shmira, but a Shomer is the next thing. Then there are Chevra Kedisha that will only do Tahara. Men do men, women do women. Okay? Then there are Chevra Kedisha that don't deal with that at all. They only deal with the Shiva house. They will make sure that the Shiva house is prepared and that there are minyanim and that the mirrors are covered and so on and so forth. Okay? So these are all different parts of what the Chevra Kedisha does. There are some Chevra Kedisha that own the cemetery grounds, oversee the cemetery grounds. Some Chevra Kedisha don't. They rely on the general cemetery, okay, or societies. So there's a big variable in what Chevra Kedisha do. However, I'd like to focus on what a tahara is. A tahara is made of three parts, and you can't take any of them away. There is, first of all, making sure that the body is clean so that all blood is saved and all the tubes are removed if possible. Most often they are. That's been my life's work, figuring out how to remove blood tubes and making sure that things don't leak and so on and so forth. So you prepare the body and then you wash the body. There's a rechitza. You wash the body just as a child is washed when it's born into this world. We wash it when it's leaving the world, right? That's a pasuk in Kehelis that teaches us that halacha. And then there is the tahara, which is either the immersion of the person into a mikveh. And by the way, chatzitza here is not the same as chatzitza for nida, because a nida is a chatzitza de'oraisa. You're dealing with halacha de'oraisa, where the slightest chatzitza is a chatzitza. Okay, here you're dealing with a drabana. In order to be a chatzitza that tassels the tahara, you have to have rova of the body covered, and the person has to be upset about it. It has to be makbid. Rubo makbid is a chatzitza on a drabana. So if you're covering one spot because there's a puncture there, and you want to cover it so it won't bleed, so that you can do a tahara, that's not a chatzitza, and it's not a problem to do it. We try to minimize the chatzitzas, but if it's necessary, then the person isn't makbid because it's necessary for them to be able to have a tahara, and it's not a chatzitza that stops the tahara. So the next thing is the tahara, which is either immersion in the mikveh or the pouring of tisha kabin, which is generally considered 24 quarts of water. The Moshe Shear is 14 quarts, but most people have 24 quarts. And then there's the halbasha, which is the dressing of the person in tachriyatin. You cannot have a body without a halbasha. You can't do a tahara without dressing the body in tachriyatin. The compromise that we make with families that are kind of mixed is we'll do a full tahara with tachriyatin, and then they will put clothing over it on top. That for Moshe and Rabbi Yaakov felt that it's still a valid tahara. It's better not, of course, but that's a compromise that we make. But there must be tachriyatin. It's like I once told a reform rabbi who wanted us to do a tahara in his father but not put on shrouds. I said to him, you'd like to have soup, but you don't want it to be liquid. I want soup with no water. I said, you can't have soup with no water. Maybe it's goulash, but it's not soup. It's cholent, but it's not soup. Soup has water. Tahara has a halbasha. It's part of the tahara. It's dressing in tachriyatin. You can't take that aspect away. It's not a tahara that is a tahara that we will do. Okay? There's a seder at tahara. We follow that seder. So you need to know this. I'm going to just end because I know I'm over time. I mean, I don't mind going, but I know it's your class is over, correct? Why?
I think you're over time.
Oh,
2:30.
Whoa! And I was rushing through. We could tell you stories. Hey, it's great. Gewaldic. So I guess we'll go to about 2:20 and then make it a bit on time. Gewaldic. Okay, I just need to pack up here. Now, so let me tell you about the Torah. So let me, first of all, this booklet has a lot of explanations of all the different minhagim. And it's very important to know the minhagim, understand the minhagim, so that you should know how to discuss this with people, explain to them. One of the most common problems you have with a family that is not frum is the clothing. They don't mind the dressing and the washing and all of that, okay? What they do mind is grandma loved that dress. She wanted to be buried in that dress. Oh, he said, bury me in that jogging suit. I love that jogging suit. I mean, people are crazy. So you want to know what to do. So first of all, I'm going to tell you a very quick story, okay? And you have to know how to explain things to people. First of all, what are tachrichim? I brought them along. I don't know if you want me to open and say tachrichim. What?
Do you mind?
I don't mind, but I'm going to tell you to throw it out afterwards because once I open it, it's going to be uncomfortable. So let me tell you, a certain tachrichim comes with the following. Number one is a sheet that wraps the entire body. So you lay this out over the arum, and it goes out like the arum is usually a rectangle. It goes on as a rectangle, and the body gets placed inside the arum, and the body is placed in that sovev, which eventually will wrap the entire body. Underneath the sovev, there is a pillow that comes with the tachrichim, and that pillow, which is this, is filled usually either with earth or more often than not with straw, or what it really is wood shavings. It's like little wood shavings that look like straw, and you fill the pillow with it. If you fill it properly, the pillow actually, the head fits on the pillow and sits on it very comfortably. Okay? So that is a pillow, and that goes under the sovev, then comes the sovev, and then the body is placed on top, so the body's head is actually a little raised. And that's the way a person is placed in the arum. There is a set of shrouds which is made to resemble the clothing that the Kohen Gadol wore when he dressed for the Avodah on Yom Kippur. Why is that? Rabbi Gamliel created the famous Hakonas Rabbi Gamliel that everyone is buried exactly the same way, and they had to come up with a set of tachrichim. So they made the exact same set of tachrichim for everybody. Everybody wears the same set of clothing like the Kohen Gadol wore. Now the Kohen Gadol wore a hat, a mitznefes, right? So there's a mitznefes, except that since there's a minhag to cover the face, because it's considered a bizayon to see the face of a person that's inanimate, that no longer has any expression. I guess some people say you could see the avarice of a person on their face, whatever it is, but there's a reason. So we cover the face. So for the men, the face cover is actually like an executioner's helmet. It goes right over the entire head, covers the face as well. No eyes are cut out. And that's the mitznefes. For women, it's slightly different. There's a bonnet, and there's a face cover, like almost what the Arab women wear, like what do they call them? Whatever it's called, okay, a shador, or whatever it is, it goes over the face, okay. So and each of these things have little ties, and they make bows in them. Never knots because we believe it's only temporary. So there's no knots in tachrichim. In fact, these tachrichim are cheap tachrichim. They're made of muslin, which is a cheap material, and they are sewn by machine. More traditional tachrichim, the ones we recommend people generally use, is made of linen, white linen, and it's sewn by hand, and there are no knots in it. So that we show that it's impermanent, okay? That's the general minhag. So this is a face cover, a head cover for the men. Then there is a shirt, Ksones Bat Kodesh Yilbash. Kohen Gadol wore a shirt. So we use a shirt. This shirt fits most people, okay? It's cut down the middle, okay? Doesn't cut all the way down, and it has a bow which ties at the neck, and that is a shirt. The pants,
but it doesn't tie.
It ties at the neck. You make like three slip knots, and then a slip knots, right? Slip knots, no real tie, no knots. Then you have a pair of pants. This is by far the most interesting garment. It's a pair of pants which are like baby pajamas. Okay? It's split down in the front. And then it's just a long thing with closed feet. Alright? Mm. And men and women wear this. Talk about that in a minute. Then there is a, and we say, you know, Michnasei Vayimiru al Besarei, there's a difference of minhagim whether you put the shirt on first or the pants on first. Now, what would you logically put on if you weren't undressed? What would you put on first? Pants. The pants. And the truth is that the Kohen Gadol put the pants on first. Except if you're familiar with the Pesukim, I don't know if anyone here is a Bal Kore, it says, Vad Kodesh Yilvash, U'michnasei Vad Yiru al Besarei. So therefore, even though if you look at the Mefarshim, Michnasei Vad Yiru al Besarei means that it already was al Besarei, okay? But nevertheless, since the Pasuk says it first, there are Minhagim that put the shirt on first and then the pants. The only thing you should know is that whichever one goes on first, the other one goes over it. So if you put the pants on first, the shirt is over the pants. We don't tuck it in. If we put the shirt on first, then the pants go over the shirt, and the shirt is tucked in. Okay? Then there's a kittel, which looks exactly like the shirt. It's even the same length as the shirt, except that it has a collar. So it's basically the same thing with a collar, and it goes over it, and that's the me'il. And then there are the gartel, the gartla. This has three, it has a gartel, which is a long belt that goes on top of the kittel and ties around the middle. There's a minhag usually to make a shin out of it and a dalad. They make a shin by making three loops up going, there's like three half knots going up, one knot going down, so you have a shin, the belt, and the knot going down is a dalad. If you can visualize it, it's a dalad, okay? And then the person is a yud, which together spells the name of Hashem. Shin, dalad, yud. The person is a yud, a yid. That is the minhag most chavrus kaddisha. Okay, now these belts. This is a belt, and then there are two little belts. These belts tie on the pants. They tie around the ankles by the men. So if you envision a man lying in the pants that have closed feet, these would tie at the ankle, and this by the women. These tie underneath the knee, right under the knee. And I'll tell you a very quick story. I was giving a shir to my women after I took over as the head of the Chevra Kedisha in 1991. I was, you know, gung-ho, I was all excited. Gave them a shir on how to do a tahara, and we get to the dressing, and I say, and you tie these belts by the ankles, and everybody raises their hand and starts screaming, what are you talking about, Rabbi? We tie it by the knee. I figure, uh-oh, they don't know what they're doing, because I've been doing taharas all the years, we tied at the ankles, and you're telling me where to tie it. Come on. Yeah, so I said, I think you're making a mistake, but let me check into it. I check in, and sure enough, the women tie it below the knee. And I start asking myself, why? And then all kinds of questions arise. What are these belts for anyway? The Kohen didn't wear belts. Not only that, the Kohen didn't have shoes either, for that matter. The Kohen walked barefoot. But that's a separate issue. We'll get to that too. But the question is, why the belts? Okay? And then there was a question of why do women wear kittels? And then the best question of all, why is it that women who wouldn't be caught dead in pants are caught dead in pants? Okay? That was the question, right? So it's a good question, right? All good questions. So when I looked to answer this minhag, everything fell into place. And I'll explain it very simply. Rabbi Gamliel decided to create a uniform set of clothes. Okay, literally a uniform. And the most logical way to do it was to make the same clothing that the Kohen Gadol wore. We believe we're going to stand for our final Yom Kippur. How are we going to appear before the Ribono Shel Olam? Like the Kohen Gadol appeared, lifnei v'lifnim. Except for a problem. Women don't wear those clothes. Okay? So, therefore, they created pants, which there was an inyan to cover the feet anyway, because in those days they didn't bury with an aron, so the feet would be sticking out. It's a bizarre to see. So they decided to make a cover for the feet. And in doing so, they were able to make pants for everybody. But they created these bands, these bendlach, as they called them, to separate to define the pants into what they were meant to be. For the men, you tie them at the ankles to indicate that the bottom is a shoe and above that is pants, because men wear shoes that go to the ankles and above that is a pair of pants. Women, until about 1920, I don't know how many of you remember Gone with the Wind, okay? But if you remember what Scarlett O'Hara dressed up in, she would wear pantaloons, which was an undergarment that tied right below the knee. Women used to wear pantaloons that tie. Everyone wore that. That was the standard woman's garment, and then there was a dress over that. So by tying this under the knee, it basically said, these are not pants, these are pantaloons. They're undergarments with a high boot. The bottom part of that pants is a boot. And then the kittel is a dress. For the men it's a kittel, for the women it's a dress. So both are wearing garments that the Kohen Gadol wore, but they're defined differently by these little bedloch. So these bedloch are very important to understand where they're coming from. Yes?
Is there no talit?
Is what?
A talit.
Yes, there is a talus that is worn for the men, okay? And we passel the talit, okay? We make it passel. And we make it passel by, in most covers, by cutting the tzitzit, okay? However, there are covers like ours that don't cut it, based on the psak of the shach, which is we make knots in it, and we tuck it into, there's always a corner on every talus, a piece of material, yeah. A knaf, we tear it open and we tuck in the tzitzit. So we make it puzzle, but it's unpuzzleable. You can make it kosher, you can kosher it just by taking it out and opening the slip knots. We don't cut it. Other chevers do it differently. There are different minhagim. It's based on tosis. Why do we make it tosis? So a person's not chayav mitzvahs. Yes?
This is a half joke, but like half serious. The Kohen Gadol's clothing, I'm sure, were probably the most expensive clothes ever worn. Like they're like 30 mana, 20 mana, that's like 20,000 zuz, 30,000 zuz, that's like probably like 100 years worth of income. If you're going to follow the Kohen Gadol, like Rabbi Gamliel's making that kind of, that people should be buried simply, so why parallel to the Kohen Gadol? The Kohen Gadol wore the most expensive clothes
again,
ever.
Again, because the Kohen Gadol's clothing symbolized Tahara, the fact that you were wearing linen. If you ever have time to look at the beginning of Yehoshua, in the Yalkut Me'am Loes, he talks about why Tachrichiv are made of linen, why the Kohen wore linen, because linen protects you from all kinds of mazikin and all kinds of spooky stuff. Okay, and he says it right there on by Rochav Hazona, who hid the Meraglin, the Pishtei Ha'etz, Vatitnan Menem, the Pishtei Ha'etz. That's where he says it. It was Pishtan, and because Pishtan protects you. Whatever, there's good reasons for it, and it happens to be that it's very cheap. It's the cheapest clothing today. So it's true that the Kohen Gadol, but it's not the money, it's basically what looks like the Kohen Gadol's clothing, not the cost of the Kohen Gadol's clothing. Okay? In that case, yes?
Is there part of the Tara that's done like with an egg?
There is a minhag in some chevers to mix some egg and vinegar and place it over the forehead. What I think, and there's a reason for that, it was a way of identifying a Jew during times when there were pogroms, there were blood libels, they would take Jews that had died and pull them out of the box. That was, they would stop to check them at a customs house, they would pull the Jew out and put in a little Catholic kid, okay, a Jewish kid, and they would bury him in the Jewish cemetery, and then they would dig up and say, oh, there's a Catholic kid missing, and they'd open the grave, and there was the kid, okay? Meanwhile, the Jew was still lying in some customs house and was thrown out in some, somewhere in some forest. Okay, so therefore they created a way of recognizing who the nifter was by smell and by touch. Okay, vinegar has a very strong smell, and eggs have a sticky touch. Egg white is what was used, and it was a way the Chevra Kedisha would check before they took the body back to see if there was a smell of vinegar. If not, they would feel if there was egg stickiness on the forehead. If not, they would insist on opening it and saying, this is not the person we buried. Okay? We're buried. So they would stop blood libels. That's what's brought down in the Kolbe. It's the only thing I've ever heard about. And both vinegar and eggs are things that have meaning in Avelus. Therefore, they are used. What is very important, I'm going to end with this, is you as Rabbanim need to know the reasons for things, why we do Kriya, why we tear Shiva, why we wear Tachrichim, why we have all these things, because people are going to ask you and you need to know, and the better you can explain it. So I'm going to tell you very, very quickly one story, and if I have time, I'll tell you a second story. The first story is a story that was actually written up. It's on our website. You can look it up. It's one of the things we usually give out. Maybe you'll get to see it. But it was a woman who called me. We have a minute, by the way, and I would encourage all of your people, if you look in the back of this, there's a form, burial wishes, that people could write information that they need at the time of death. And among the information is their Jewish name. Many people die and no one knows their Jewish name, or it's perverted, whatever it is. So keep a record. Encourage people to keep their Jewish names and tell their people. Okay? But in any case, the point is a woman calls me. I call a woman on Tzai Shabbos and I say to her, we're doing a Tahara on your husband. Would you please tell us his Hebrew name? So the woman says to me, Rabbi, take good care for my husband. He was a tzaddik. So I said, a tzaddik? Ooh, what does that mean? We take care of everybody. What is it? She said, as she put it, in World War I, he was in the American army, he didn't miss one day of putting on film. Now, can you imagine what it means to put on film in the army in World War I? Jews were supposed to have horns in those days. You know, people had no idea what Jews were. You put on film every day. Forget about it. The guy must have been a tzaddik. So obviously, I come to the funeral home an hour later to do the Tahara, and the funeral director says to me, Rabbi, don't casket this body because they're putting clothing on afterwards. A suit. I said, what, are you crazy? He says, no, there's the suit right there. Sure enough, suit with his name on it. So I called the woman back. I said, can I call this wife back? It doesn't sound right. I called her back and I said, we're at the Tahara, and I didn't even finish. She says, Rabbi, I know, it's not me, it's my daughter, and I can't fight with her no more. So I said, do you mind if I call your daughter? She says, no. I said, give me the number. I called the daughter, and immediately she says, Rabbi, please, you don't know my daughter. I mean, you don't know my father. I said, but your mother told me that he was a very righteous man. He obviously davened, and he obviously put on tefillin and sacrificed for it, and did it. Rabbi, you're 1,000% right, but you still don't know your father. My father. I said, do you go to shul every day? Yes. He's very active in the shul. I said, so how can you put a suit on? She says, Rabbi, my father was the nattiest dresser who ever lived. I said, what does that mean? She says, my father retired 20 years ago. All he did for the rest of his life, all day, was shop. Wouldn't buy every day. He would only buy the finest clothes. This is what he spent his life doing. And at the end, every night, he would spend 45 minutes to an hour laying out his next day's clothing. This had to match that. He put this back. He had closets full of clothes. He says, I can't see him being buried in a shroud. Okay. Makes sense? I mean, begins. So I said to her, I thought about it for a minute. I said, what did your father wear when he went to sleep? She says, designer pajamas made of silk. And what did he wear when he went swimming? Says designer trunks. I said, why didn't he wear the suit that's at Parkside when he went to sleep? It's a beautiful suit. She says, Rabbi, you're making fun of me. I said, no, I'm making a point. I said, the reason he didn't wear that beautiful suit, because your father was always dressed for the occasion. Dressed to kill, but dressed for the occasion. I said, what's appropriate dress for this occasion? Did you ever think about that? I said, your father believed in God. So he believes he's going to stand before God. How do you stand before God? Is God impressed by a designer suit? Is that what impresses him? Or is it like the Kohen Gadol wore? I said, this suit has so much meaning. I said, you know what the funny thing is? I said, your father, because they're putting a suit on him, the funeral director put out a plain set of shrouds made of muslin. I said, which is the cheap shrouds. I was going to say to her, your father wouldn't be caught dead in the shroud. You know, he should be wearing a linen shroud. But because they're dressing him, they're not going to waste the linen shroud, which costs more money. Therefore, I said, why don't you do what's appropriate? And she started crying. She says, Rabbi, I'll pick up the suit tomorrow. And we dressed him in tachrich. But the point is, you need to be able to know what to say. That's the bottom line. Dama lahashiv. And in a world where cremation is growing to be 50% or more, it's now 40% among Jews, I believe that. We need to know what to say, how to say, and that's why a lot of this stuff is here, okay? Use us as a resource. Feel free to reach out to me at any time. This is an urn we just created, which opens at the bottom. These two little planks on the bottom pull up along the side, but it's done inside the grave. The body goes all the way down, and then these two things pull it up along the side on this side, and from this side on that side, and now the body is lying completely in the ground. Okay? You should know it exists. It's a little toy of mine. It's actually been patented by me. Okay? And it's now available. Okay? I figured if I run out of things to do, we can talk about it. Okay? Anyway, I'm sorry to keep you. And if you can, if someone, feel free to take these back with you. You can sell it. It doesn't